Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com. Upwork.com.
I thought we were going to talk about comic books also, like that huge moral panic over comic books.
Seduction
back in the day.
Of the Innocent.
Frederick Fairton.
Librarians themselves use to justify not purchasing comics for the library. Yeah.
Welcome back to Just the Facts with me, Jill Winebanks, the Watergate girl. And I am so excited about today's episode. I can't tell you. I am, first of all, doing something I've never done, which is I have 3 guests at the same time. We are all united in our love of books and our fear of book banning. And so it's going to be a really interesting, just off the cuff conversation. I'm thrilled that everybody was willing to do this and that everybody was able to join at the same time. Amazing. So let me just introduce the audience to all of you. I'm starting on my, just above my picture is Diane Wachtel, who is the co-founder and the current executive director of The New Press, which is an amazing publisher of public interest materials. They focus on everything that is social issues, cultural issues, political issues, and from, I would say, a more left of center point of view. And very important books. When you look at their catalog, you're going to want to read every single book they've published. It was amazing to me to look at their catalog. But more relevant to today's topic, which is the banning of books, they have at least 3 books that have been banned by the Navy, and we're going to talk about that. Diane's been busy talking to the press about it, and I think it's a really important thing. But it's also, you should know that Diane has written a parody of a wonderful children's book. The children's book is a huge bestseller called Pat the Bunny, and she wrote Pat the Money, which raises the age of the main characters to boomers who are obviously more interested in money than all the wonderful things that are in Pat the Bunny. And then we also have with us Betsy Bird, who I found from my personal experience is a really dynamic speaker. She and I are neighbors, it turns out. We drove from Evanston to a book event where she was speaking about one of her many children's books, and I was speaking about The Watergate Girl. And we had a lovely conversation on a very long drive to the event. And then she transformed herself. When she got up to speak, Betsy Bird was like this actress who just had energy and she was amazing. And I had to follow speaking. So that was really a challenge to me. She is the head of the children's division of the Evanston Public Library. And as I said, she's also a dynamic speaker and an author of children's books. And finally, we have with us Kyle Lukoff, who has worked in bookstores his whole life and has gotten his degree in library science and worked as a librarian before he became a prolific children's book writer. And we're going to talk about a lot of his books. I have looked at many of them, and I would say that they are warm and engaging and very real. His characters are often trans people, but they are really just wonderful people who do interesting things. And one, for example, is about becoming an older brother to a new baby, which is an experience that everyone has. And it's sort of irrelevant what the gender of the person is. It's a lovely book. And unfortunately, of course, because so many of his characters are trans people, his books have been banned. And he is a plaintiff in a lawsuit in Florida, where I saw a clip of Governor DeSantis holding up his book saying, bad, bad, bad. This is why we have to act. Not bad, bad, bad. And we're going to talk about that as well as his being a plaintiff in that lawsuit in Florida. But we're going to also talk about a Supreme Court argument this week about avoiding banning books by letting parents opt their children out of classes in which books are taught that have a theme that they say doesn't fit their religious background. So let's just start with a sort of a lightweight thing, which is, I know we're all united in our love of books. And I have always found inspiration and comfort in books. I was a shy girl and lived vicariously through books. And so I just sort of wonder what each of you, you know, how you got interested in books and what they meant to you. You want to, let's go round robin. So Diane, you go first.
Wow. I just don't even know where to begin. I mean, I was obviously a voracious reader. I'm sure all of us were as a young person. When I was in college, I know that you called out my little parody, Jill. Thank you for that. I've done some serious books too. But I met my husband writing a travel guide about Mexico, Let's Go Mexico. And that's how I got into the publishing industry. That series was published by St. Martin's Press. They interviewed all the editors and so forth. And so I just kind of slid from a comparative literature degree in college right into publishing and have stayed there ever since.
And Betsy, how did you get to be a children's writer and librarian?
I was doomed to be a librarian. From a very young age, I was the kind of kid who would take her National Geographics and make subject heading lists for fun. I would take the VHS tapes and create little, like, how to find which one in the bookshelf where we kept them. That's what I did in my spare time. But I thought librarianship was boring and I wasn't going to do it. I was going to be a photographer. That was a sexy job. I'm a terrible photographer. And it turns out I'm an okay librarian. So when I finally acquiesced and became a librarian, I discovered children's librarianship, which is delightful. The best possible of all the librarianships, I dare say so. Fight me. And that's how I got into it. And then I always wanted to be an author, but I was a very practical child. And I was like, no, healthcare. So that's where being the librarian and then being the author works out. Though Kyle has many more guts than I did and managed to transition from full-time librarianship to full-time author. So
I just have to add, you're going to have to come to my house because I have shoeboxes. They're actually not shoeboxes. I actually bought them to fit DVDs, and they are labeled British comedy, British drama. I have done my, I didn't realize that that was like, I guess I'm a librarian at heart. Mm-hmm. But I'm also an aspiring children's book writer. So I am very interested in all the things that you have to say. And Kyle, what about you?
What about me in which direction? I feel like each of them got slightly different questions.
Well, no, I was just asking how you got into love with books and got to being a children's book author.
Yeah, so I was one of those kids who always had a book with me no matter where I went. I read in the car. I remember going to lunch with my parents and bringing a book with me. I read at my brother's swim meets. I can't tell you why. It is just the only thing that I've ever liked to do more than anything else. But I didn't know what kind of job that could turn into because I didn't want to work in publishing. I didn't want to shepherd just one book from, you know, inception into publication. And when I was 16, I got a job at Barnes & Noble, and I really liked that. But the thing with Barnes & Noble is that they don't exactly pay you a living wage until you probably get up to the manager side of things. Yeah. But I didn't want to be a manager. I just wanted to tell people what books they might like. And then I was hanging out at my friend's house, which was actually a houseboat illegally docked in Brooklyn, New York. And he opened up his mail and he was like, hey, I got into library school. And I was like, library school, is that like a thing that people do? And he said, I guess so, because I'm doing it now. And I was like, why am I not in library school right now? I should be doing that too. So I applied, I quit Barnes & Noble, and then I spent the next 9 years as a librarian in different private schools in New York City, and also trying to see if I could maybe get a book published someday, because that seemed cool. And then by 2020, I had, I don't even remember, maybe 5 books by then. And then I decided to leave my job to see if I could make it work as a full-time author. And now I have my 19th book comes out at the end of this month. So that's 19 published books in 7 years.
That's pretty prolific, I would say. I know how long I've been working on just one. So congratulations on that. So let's, maybe I'll start with you talking about being a banned book author. By the way, I usually wear a pin. I'm not wearing a pin today. So for anyone who's watching this on YouTube as opposed to listening to a podcast, I'm wearing I Read Banned Books t-shirt. I thought that was better than a pin to wear that I read banned books. So I read banned books. So tell me how you got banned and how you're dealing with it. And I think you're a plaintiff in a lawsuit because you have a banned book. So let's start with that. And then we can maybe talk about the Supreme Court and about the wonderful thing that Illinois has done to ban banning books.
So I'm really regret. I was going to wear a t-shirt that my favorite t-shirt that says the moral panic is about me. And I'm really regretting not wearing that now that I know that you're wearing that t-shirt. Yeah. I also have a button that says the moral panic is about me that I wore before.
Well, you should have worn a pin for my show, because I have hashtag Jill's pins on social media.
Oh, well, I'll know for next time.
Okay.
So, you know, I was very confident that my books were going to be banned. When my picture book, When Aiden Became a Brother, came out, I was still working as a school librarian. And actually, I once went to a children's literature salon that Betsy organized with the author Roby Harris, whose books, you know, she's one of the most banned authors, I think, of all time. And one of her books was being challenged in my library. And I got to talk to her about what that was like for her. At that time, I had no idea that I would then become an extremely banned author, but I was prepared for it by the time Aiden came out. I had a meeting with my boss, actually, the principal of my school, saying to him, look, like, I have this picture book about a trans boy. I'm openly trans. I am not expecting a tsunami of hate, but also open to the possibility. And I want to make sure that this school as an institution is also prepared for me being in the middle of some kind of media firestorm. That did not happen with Aiden. It wasn't until January of 2021 that I first became aware of more widespread efforts to ban some of my books. The first case that I became aware of was in Utah about my early reader, Call Me Max. And then a month later, I learned about a similar situation at a school district outside of Austin, Texas. And from there, it just really metastasized. And not just my books, but so many of my colleagues' books. For so many different reasons.
What is Tell Me Max? Why was that banned?
Sure. Call Me Max. I have all my books next to me in a very precarious pile because there's 19 of them. But Call Me Max is an early reader about a young trans boy just telling his family and the world about himself. I wrote it intentionally to be as anodyne and banal as possible because I wanted to force book banners to be clear and specific about the fact that they did not like trans people, rather than that there was some detail that they were latching onto as a smokescreen for their larger issues. And it just continued from there. The most recent case that I'm aware of was in Stillwater, Minnesota, also about Call Me Max from, I think, a month or two ago, very recently. And unfortunately, the book banning movement has shaped my entire career over these last 4 years in ways that are both mostly negative. The most interesting positive for me, though, is that I was curious to see if people would ban my book if there was nothing else objectionable in it aside from the simple existence of a trans person, I learned that they would, and now I don't care. So now I'm being much more forthright and unapologetic about the kinds of stories I want to tell.
So let me move to Diane, because you have books that have been banned that you have published. And so talk about the content of them and what could possibly be objectionable. Not that I think that there's anything objectionable about a trans boy being Call Me Max, but yours are what? History books.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Well, sure. Ours are a range of books on progressive issues. And I think, as all of you probably know, there are at least two kind of strands of books that are being banned. And the first strand is the strand that's affecting Max and, or sorry, Kyle and Betsy, which is books for young people that are largely about gender and sexuality. Right. But the whole other strand is books for college-age students, some high school students, and up through adults that are more, you know, pitched at the university level or for general readers, for that matter, on race, ethnicity, police violence, the Holocaust, a range of issues that are deemed to be controversial. And for whatever reason, you know, this administration, but it even precedes this administration, a set of people feel misrepresent our history and are subjects to which they make people feel bad, especially, say, high school students, and people shouldn't be exposed to these issues. So our books are on a whole range of those issues, and they have been banned for a number of years now, many of them, but obviously the volume has gone way up.
And recently you had an episode with the Navy banning books. So
I'll back up and say one of our best-selling books of all time was published in 2010, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, which makes an argument about mass incarceration being kind of the next iteration after slavery and Jim Crow. And now we just incarcerate people of color and deprive them of all the rights that otherwise we couldn't deprive them of under current law. So that book has been banned, particularly in prisons and jails over the years since it was published. And I will say, every time it gets banned somewhere, the ACLU in that state steps up and files a suit, and we get it reinstated, particularly in prisons and jails. So that's a good story, you know, in the end. But more recently, with the bans that have come in over, I would say, the last 2 to 3 years, there's been a huge uptick. It's, you know, books across, not across the political spectrum, but across the spectrum of topics that I just outlined. Yeah. And then there was a moment also, you may recall, when there was a big brouhaha about the African-American AP curriculum. A number of new press books, including Kim Crenshaw's edited volume, Critical Race Theory. Like, we have the 1995 seminal writings on critical race theory as part of our series backlist. And that obviously was at the heart of all the anti-CRT stuff. So that book and the New Jim Crow and some others were pulled from the AP African American History curriculum. So coming up more recently with all the bans and at the K-12 level, a teacher in many states could go to prison, conceivably, for handing a new press book to a student in a public school classroom. And that's true of Kyle's book, and that's his book as well. Right?
I mean, to me, this is like the end of education and culture in America. To me, books are a place to discover, to get new views, to get new ideas, to understand other things. I remember taking comparative religion. They weren't trying to convert me to any particular religion. They were just exposing me to religions that I didn't know. And I think it's so important for us to all get along to understand the similarities and the differences and that they don't really matter, is the bottom line. So, Betsy, talk about what Illinois has done to stop this. And then I want all of us to talk about what everyone listening here can do to make sure that books aren't banned from their libraries, from their schools. But talk about the Illinois law first, Betsy.
Yeah, it's a very interesting law. Pritzker signed this into law, I think it was on June 12th of 2023. So there you go. Now, the law is very specific. It protects the freedom of libraries to acquire materials without external limitations. So when we say it's an anti-book banning law, it is, but it doesn't say anything about what happens once the books are on the shelves. But it certainly says that when it comes to the acquisition of materials, you aren't having people saying, no, you shouldn't buy this for this reason or this reason or this reason.
Happens once it's on the shelf? You mean people could steal it or deface it?
People could steal a book anyway. You know, that happens all the time. Or misshelve it. That's a very clever technique they sometimes use. Either they'll steal the book or they'll misshelve the book or they'll check it out and never return the book. If you're a library, this is just what it is. So, but by gum, you've acquired it. So that is something, and it is the very first of these laws that was ever adopted by a state in direct response to the fact that all this was happening. It's an interesting law. There's not much to compare it to. I would like to see more of those laws. Yeah. I'd like to see them talk about what happens after you get the book as well. But it's a good start at the very least. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you and I are very blessed to live in Illinois with a Governor Pritzker, and in Evanston in particular, which would never ban a book. I mean, I can't even imagine someone running for...
No, we do get challenges once in a while, but it tends to be when there's a giant gun on a Pinkerton cover. And that happens once every 10 years. So
Yeah. I think we're in a unique community.
Yeah, then we also keep...
You know, let's go back to the... What does ban... You know, well, maybe start with, how do we stop this? It seems to me that school board elections become much more important. Library board elections become important because if the people who are running are all the ones who are hopped up about making sure their kids don't get exposed to the real world, then you are going to have limitations put on, in place. And that maybe that's one place that we can start to combat this. What else can we do? Obviously, we can read and buy banned books. Obviously, you can only read them in places that haven't yet banned them, but you can always purchase one from your, even if it's only online. But what else can we do? I mean, it seems, I know people keep writing to me for everything saying, what can I do to stop the loss of our democracy? What can I do to stop a king taking over our country? Any thoughts?
I've had many different conversations with teachers, librarians, administrators, all kinds of people who are suddenly put in the middle of this huge community debate wherever it is that they're living. And, you know, I do agree with you that school boards are incredibly important, that attending school board meetings are incredibly important. That's all useful on a practical level, but also on a more theoretical level, I think. I hear a lot of people saying, I just want everyone to feel included. I want everyone to feel supported. I want everyone to hear that their voice matters. And I understand and appreciate where that is coming from. However, when it comes to this issue, it is impossible to make people happy because there are some people who want their children to be able to access a diverse range of materials and who may or may not want their children reading certain books, but are also not calling for those books to be removed wholesale. And then you also have people who are saying, I believe that these individuals are perverts, groomers, pedophiles, that they are a danger to my child and that they should be removed from all public life. And there is no way of making both groups of people happy. And an attempt to do so will only end up catering to the loudest and ultimately most violent voices in the room. So on a certain level, I think people just need to essentially grow a backbone and understand that they are in fact fighting for something that is right. And that fighting for something that is right sometimes means telling people that they are wrong.
So let's you mentioned two different categories, and one of them is before the Supreme Court this week. And that is a case in Montgomery County, Maryland, which I lived in when I lived in Washington my first year, or maybe two, and maybe just the first year that I lived in Washington. I lived in Montgomery County, which is a very well-to-do, pretty liberal community. But there are some parents who are avoiding trying to ban books, but they're saying, I have to be able to opt out for my child. They can't sit in a class where there is a marriage between same-sex people. They can't be in the classroom if you're going to talk about those. You have to give me a warning, and then I have to pull my child out of that class. And Montgomery County allowed that for a year or two, and then they realized it wasn't really workable. And it also, more importantly to me anyway, is that it seems Brisby agrees with me, and he may be joining us. Here he comes. It seems to me that if we don't allow children to meet each other and to understand each other, then they're going to grow up to be bigoted adults. And so that it's really important to not allow people to opt out. But I'm really worried. I know, Kyle, you had some opinions about the case, which is Mahmoud versus Taylor. And I'm concerned about it. And I think you are. Talk about why you're concerned. And Betsy, it looks like you want to say something too, so chime in there too. But yeah. Go ahead, Kyle.
You go first because I just talked.
Okay, go ahead, Betsy.
Okay, I just want to say this is very much a civil rights issue. And let's remember that when the civil rights movement first started, we didn't have a ton of children's books written by Black people about the Black experience. If we had, I can guarantee you we'd be saying this exact same objection at that time. You would have had people saying, well, I want to opt out. And in fact, we are seeing that today, too, because they'll be like, oh, these are critical race theory books about just regular Black people living their lives. But we would have seen that argument in some form. They probably wouldn't have used that term, but they would have used some sort of term to say, you know, I'm not comfortable seeing Black and white people, you know, marrying each other and having kids in picture books. But we didn't have the publishing industry at the point that it was, and we didn't have the internet. So you didn't have that objection back during the original civil rights movement. Now you have a plethora, a golden age, if you will, of children's literature, where you are seeing so many more voices than you ever did before. And of course, inevitably, there's this backlash. So if you're telling people you can opt out of knowing that these people even exist for your children, that is a very different argument than the kind of argument you'd be like, where you'd say, like, I would rather my kid not learn about, you know, the people can opt out of whether their kids have sex ed or something. That's a different issue entirely.
Yeah. You'll have people saying, I don't want my kids to understand about slavery.
I don't want them to know that people exist.
Right. So go ahead, Kyle. What was your reaction to it?
Yeah. Well, so as a dovetail to that, on the one hand, this is very much about the books and very much about the right to read. But on the other hand, it is also very much about the rights of queer and trans people to simply exist in a society. So if the question is, I want my children to opt out from learning about trans people through a book, the question then for me is, what happens if there is a child in that class who comes out as trans? Yeah. Will parents have to opt out? Will parents get the choice of having their children leave that classroom?
Oh.
Will parents get to vote on whether that child deserves to stay in school at all? And then expanding that, I was a school librarian. I am trans. That was not a secret from my students. Should parents be allowed to opt out before having their children see me in the library or see me in the cafeteria? And then, I mean, there are trans parents. Like, trans people are not just, like, children or rhetorical figures. Many of my trans friends have children. If a child's parent picks them up from school, should the other parents be allowed to opt out of having that child's mother or father pick them up from school because that mother or father is trans? And then also, should parents be allowed to opt out of seeing a trans woman at the grocery store or at the gas station or at the local diner? When you were saying that parents should be allowed to opt out of having their children learn that trans people exist, what you are saying is that we should not be allowed to exist in the public sphere at all. And I think it's reasonable for me to take umbrage at that as a person who likes to go to the grocery store and the gas station and the local diner.
But, you know, if you substitute the word black for trans in that statement, the ridiculousness of the argument becomes clear, because no one would say you can opt out of a classroom with a black student in it.
I mean, and, I would say that school segregation is still quite an issue to be fought over. I'm not sure if it's quite, if we've come as far as I might have liked.
Well, for sure not. I mean, of course, I'm much older. So when I was growing up, and I lived in a very middle-class white neighborhood, pretty much Jewish neighborhood, and my parents sent me to a Y camp because they wanted me to know that the world wasn't my white middle-class Jewish neighborhood. And I was so young that I didn't even know that I was supposed to think differently. And I judged people on, are you a good canoer? Do you swim well? Do you make a good lanyard? Does anybody here know what a lanyard is?
Oh, heck yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So those were my criteria for judging people. And it's a good life lesson. And if we don't even have that in our schools, and actually public education to me is a place where we all come together and get to know each other. And it's only by knowing each other that we can live civilly together. Right, Brisby? Thank you very much. So yes. All right. Let's talk a little bit more. So we've been talking about the Mahmoud case versus Taylor is really where parents are trying to avoid banning and opting out. But did you have something to say, Diane?
I just wanted to muddy the waters in a
go ahead.
unprovocative way.
Be provocative. Provocative.
Supposing some parents said, I don't want my kids exposed to books with Jewish people in them.
Yes.
What would this administration, with their, we must tamp down on anti-Semitism, have to say about that? I mean, it's just absurd.
Don't get me started on that, because this is not, nothing he is doing is to fight anti-Semitism. He is trying to ferment anti-Semitism, and we are going to end up getting the blame for anything that goes wrong now. This is, it's absurd. But let's.
You could extend this opting out thing. Yeah. To ad infinitum and ad absurdum, right? Yeah.
Yeah, good thing. So, Kyle, what are you suing about?
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Kyle.
Oh, me.
You're a plaintiff in a lawsuit,
yes,
right?
That's true. I am a plaintiff in a lawsuit, which is Penn America et al. I'm one of the et al's, the Escambia County, Florida. And that is a case where many books, including my own, have been either removed from a school library or placed in a restricted section. And our argument is that our books should be made accessible to children in the same way that any other books which have been acquired by a trained library media professionals should be accessible. I'm not sure where we're at in that. I know that I was deposed over the summer.
Oh, good.
It was a very unpleasant experience.
I'm sorry about
it's
that.
Okay.
Lawyers can be nasty, but I'm nice.
It was very interesting. I actually went to law school for about 6 weeks.
Really?
And so I did, yeah. I found it to be a very interesting experience, but it was also somewhat unpleasant.
My husband went for 1 week and went, oh, this is horrible. I'm getting out of here. I'm getting a degree in philosophy. So he went for a master's in philosophy instead. Sorry. But that was, yeah. And I get it. I took a year off after my first year because I hated it too. And I didn't want to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a writer. And I thought there has to be a better way to get a journalism job than finishing law school. This is horrible. So I totally get it. And good luck with that lawsuit, because anything that we do to keep books free and fair, I think is really important. I can't think of anything more important than reading and knowing alternative viewpoints. And, you know, going back to the free marketplace of ideas, that's how we come to truth. And that's what this show is all about, is just the facts. And we can't get to truth if we, you know, don't allow ourselves to read everything. And is anything you want to say, anybody, about what is the harm of banning books? Is it as significant as I think it is if people can't access books? And you mentioned about in a restricted area, which is, you know, sort of like in the old days in video shops, porn was in a restricted area. And when I was general counsel of the Army, and Diane and I have a mutual friend who was the head of Playboy, and Playboy magazine was banned from the AFEs, the post exchanges. And I thought that was a violation of the First Amendment. And so, and I did not know Christy at the time. I had never met her, but I had one of my staff do some research on whether the First Amendment was violated, and he concluded that it was. And then I had to negotiate with the chaplain, and it was an Army Air Force system. So I had to negotiate with the Air Force as well as the Army. We ended up saying they would be behind a block so that only the word Playboy showed, the nude picture of on the cover wouldn't show. And, you know, for back then, that was it didn't stop people from buying it. Sales went back up. And so it was an okay solution. I would hope that there would be better solutions than that going forward, and that you succeed in your lawsuit to prevent a restricted area for your books. And we should mention, I think, if I'm not wrong, Aiden has a brother, or becomes a brother. Aiden becomes a brother.
When Aiden became a brother, yeah.
When Aiden became a brother. Actually, the family is African-American, are they not? So it's not just that he's a trans boy, but his family is like any other family. You're not writing just from your own experience. So I thought that was interesting. But so anything to say about either the dangers and harm and why we should fight and how we can fight to keep books available? And as Diane said, it's not just children's books that are being banned, but that's a good place to start stopping it, because that's the most formative years. So what do you guys think?
Children's books are where the moral panics always begin. It's always the case. And when you look at the three great rise and fall of banning in America, from the Tea Party to, you know, to when Harry Potter and Pokemon was the greatest threat to now.
I thought we were going to talk about comic books also, like that huge moral panic over comic books.
Seduction
back in the day.
Of the Innocent.
Frederick
Fairton. Librarians themselves used to justify not purchasing comics for the library. Yeah. I'm just imagining.
Does that include graphic novels as well?
Of course.
Are graphic novels
all comics. All comics were going to turn your child into a juvenile delinquent. This was proven.
So. Veronica and Betty and Archie?
Oh, yeah.
That may be a reference that nobody else gets but me.
Oh, no. My mom read Pep comics. I was well-versed on all that. So thank you. Yes. No. All comics were considered by librarians to be truck. To be just terrible, and rot the brains of the youth. So, you know, this wave comes and goes. The problem is now we have the internet, so the wave would just keep going up. Also, yeah. Better organized now, I gotta say. You know, Moms for Liberty, they're the yes. ones responsible for a great many of the bannings around this country. A lot of the bannings take place in places where those people don't even live. So
are there any organizations to combat Moms for Liberty? I mean, you have the Federalist Society, and then you have the American Constitution Society that is on the other side of that. Is there anything that is as big and organized as Moms for Liberty?
Well, I would say PEN is very well organized. The ACLU is very well organized. Yeah. The Center for Constitutional Rights plays a role. I mean, there are a number of groups that are combating this. And just in terms of how can we push back, you know, I think in general, not just with book banning, but, you know, I get asked this question all the time. And I think we stay in our lanes and we do what we know how to do. So, although you can push the boundaries a little bit. So, for example, the New Press did file our very first amicus brief ever in the Florence woke case. That was something we could do because our books were implicated. A lot of them are banned in Florida. We organized a whole gala around Stand with the Banned and did a lot of subsidiary activities. We put out reading lists of banned books. We worked in concert with the Zinn Education Project to give free copies of banned books to teachers across the country and mail them to their home addresses because it could have caused them problems to have them mailed to their school addresses. And then we've commissioned a whole range of new books that speak directly to the issue. So certainly a number of books about trans families and trans kids playing sports and so forth, books on the racial history of this country, books on the First Amendment per se. Those are some things that we've been able to do. I think anyone can support groups that are pushing back against book banning. That's something anyone can do with money, with volunteering time, with you know, being supportive of their local librarians and school districts, et cetera. You guys probably have more ideas than that.
And I would say also support Ali Velshi on MSNBC, who features banned books all the time and has a banned book club, which is important because it reaches a general audience. So one last question maybe, which is, I am an aspiring children's book writer. You are successful and prolific in your cases. Both Betsy and Kyle are prolific, and Diane has, as she said, written serious books.
Wait, Jill. I've published over 1,000 books.
Okay, well, that's, yes. But I'm talking about the writing, just the writing. Writing. So I used to host a show called iGen Politics, which was an intergenerational conversation that Victor Xi, who I met when he was 17, we were both elected as Biden delegates, and that's how we met. And we started this podcast to bring together his perspective as a 17-year-old and mine as a many years older than him. And we would interview people. And we always would ask our guest, what advice do you have for the younger generation? So even though I'm older than all of you, I am asking, what's your advice to me as a newbie attempting author? What makes a book successful? What do I do?
I recently subscribed to a Substack called, now I don't remember. I think it's Reading Picture Books. It's with John Klassen and Mac Barnett.
Okay.
And they do an incredible job of breaking down picture books as an art form. And beyond reading that one, I think that the best advice that I have is to read a lot of successful picture books and then pick apart what makes them work.
I'm actually aiming a little older. I started out with a picture book because someone approached me with the idea of including Brisby, who is my beloved Dalmatian, in the book. But I couldn't think of a message I wanted to send to children young enough to read a picture book. So I'm now more middle grade, where I think I have a story to tell that they might be interested in. But I'm not sure there's that much difference other than, I mean, obviously, the word level changes, sentence structure can be a little more complex, not not like my legal writing, but.
Well, actually, picture books can actually have more complicated sentence structure than certain books aimed at independent readers, because picture books are meant to be read aloud to children by adults. And then also picture books have more in common with structured poetry, I would say, than a short story.
Yeah.
Whereas novels tend to follow a more classic, you know, introduction, rising action, climax, falling action. So they're actually very different art forms. So Betsy, you might have more to say about that.
No, that's perfectly said. Also, two thumbs up on that Substack you mentioned. I also would recommend the illustration department, which is a good one as well. But yeah, I completely agree. Like if you're writing middle grade, you know, the best advice, obviously, and we all say it, and we say it every time, but it's always true, is to read a bunch of middle grade. Yeah. But not just the classics. Read what's coming out right now. And I'm just going to hammer this home again. We are in a golden age of children's literature right now.
I know.
We are seeing
I have
better
Too
books.
Bright to See, which won a bunch of awards.
Okay. Yes. What is that one called? Wait, what's it called?
Too Bright to See.
Too Bright
to
See.
Well, I believe that won a Newbery Honor, one of the highest.
Oh, it did. It sure did, Betsy. You're right about that.
Fancy that, along with a National Book Award honor and what have you.
Nah,
but yes,
you know.
Well, I have a good librarian to recommend things to me.
Oh, there you go. There you go. That is very key. Yeah, find a good librarian. I love my profession, but let me tell you, find a librarian who knows what's being made right now.
Okay.
That is key.
Well, I've been reading a lot of memoir and biography and autobiography because that's what I'm sort of working on. And it's fascinating. And I've read the adult version, the young adult, the middle grade, and sometimes the picture book. And it's interesting to see the development. And I most of them started at the adult memoir and then worked their way down. I should maybe check more carefully what the publishing dates are to make sure that I'm correct in that. It's just, I'm reading them in that order, so maybe I'm wrong. Well, thank you all. It's been fascinating. I knew it would be a great conversation, and I hope that you all enjoyed it too. And for all our listeners, if you can think of anything that any of us, and I mean that in the most generic sense, can do to help protect books and keep them published and readable, available for reading, I guess is the correct grammar on that. Please find me on social media. I'm on everything. I prefer Blue Sky nowadays, but you can find me also. LinkedIn is good, and I'm on Facebook, all of those things. But try and find me and send me the ideas. And I'd love to publish them and try to promote some of the stuff. And Diane, keep on doing what you are doing, because that is critical.
Well, the fact that everyone, we're all in this together.
That's the favorite saying of my sister-in-law, my hashtag sister-in-law podcast partner, Joyce Vance, who ends her great Substack, Civil Disobedience, "We're in this together." And we are, and it's a big fight that we must be up to the task of. So thank you all. Keep up the fight.
Well, thank you.
Nice
to meet everybody.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose.
Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.